Test. Test.
Hey, Ahmed, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
All right. Thank you, brother. We'll start. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to We Are In This Together, fourth episode with our guest, Amer Zahar. Amer, welcome.
Hello.
Let me introduce you, although as far as our community, you are in no need for introduction. Amer Zahar is an Arab-American comedian, speaker, writer, academic, and adjunct professor at University of Detroit Mercy School of Law. He draws on his experiences growing up as a child of Palestinian immigrant parents, performing and lecturing on topics like politics, society, Islam, growing up Arab, and more. Amer holds an MA in Middle East Studies and a law degree, both from the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. He writes and speaks widely on political and social affairs and has appeared on radio and television, including ABC's Politically Incorrect with Bill Maher. Some of his writings have been featured in major publications, including Time Magazine and Al Jazeera, and recently a lot more than that. Mm-hmm. Amer has performed throughout North America and the Middle East, including shows in America and the various colleges internationally. There is a more detailed bio of Amer. You'll find it on his website, showing over here. Now, I want to say this. Amer actually, for me, is one of the unsung heroes and soldiers of this community. Those who work hard for it, and all based on volunteer time, asking for no return, and seeking no leadership position. He's been on the forefront in the community fighting for the Palestinian issue. He's been on the forefront representing us in our support for Bernie Sanders. He's a surrogate for Bernie's campaign and a campaign activist in Michigan. He has been representing our Arab American interest as far as the census is concerned and listing us as a race. He's also on the forefront of Arab American comedy, which is a very important language in America to speak to. To speak through. He's also a professor of law who has a lot of influence on the legal understandings of issues that has to do with us. He also organizes the comedy festival, and he's also a youth motivational speaker, something that you might not know about Amer, that he goes to various schools, speaks to youth, a great motivational speaker, breaking the stereotype of older Arab men lecturing younger children. So it's always interesting to see the reaction of children, that we actually can be funny and understand humor in there within their context and their culture. So that's what I know. I know he does a lot more than that.
Please stop.
I know you didn't expect that, but I wanted to give you a moment really of recognition.
I appreciate that. Well, for everyone out there who might listen to this, my mother wrote that bio. You know, she put together all those things. But, you know, I just try to do what I can. And I think it's incumbent upon all of us, including you. You know, you do great work, too, just to do what little bits we can to make sure that our voices are always heard.
I mean, especially lately, just being on Fox News and winning the debate on Fox News, that's unprecedented by itself. So we can, anyway, so thank you very much, Amer, for really for all you do.
My pleasure.
And thank you for being with us on this episode. If you got what I'm trying to do, is I'm trying to basically reflect from a human perspective on the situation that we're living right now. We're actually living history. As it unfolds, we don't know how it's going to happen. And I consider these documents that we are saving for history, really. Yeah. So today, of course, you being on the show, we have to talk about a few topics other than what we usually speak about on this show. So we're going to go to later. We're going to talk about Bernie Sanders and his campaign. And we're going to talk about the census, because I know you want to talk about it, and I want you to talk about it. And I've seen your video that you've posted a couple of days ago about it too. And at the end, we have a tradition that we do. We're going to do that tradition. So before we go to these two topics, I want to basically go over our basic questions that we ask in this living. We're in this together. That's the name of the show.
Yeah.
So basically, how are you doing?
I'm great. You know, I'm bored. You know, we're all sitting at home these days. We're doing things like this instead of, you know, getting physically together. And it's boring. But, you know, we all have to remember that we are in this together. You know, that's been the message of something I've been trying to spread for a long time. It's why I got involved in the Bernie Sanders campaign. I mean, you know, all of us are going to suffer a little bit because of this thing, right? I mean, you know, I'm a comedian. I don't have a traditional job, but in times like this, you know, I've had about 15 or 20 shows canceled. And I know that, you know, hopefully they'll all come back and hopefully everything will come back to normal. But, you know, it's a crazy world that we live in. But my Palestinian refugee immigrant dad probably explained it the best to me a couple weeks ago. He said to me, you know, he said, Amir, people are starting to understand that we are in this together. They used to think that if you get sick, that is your problem. Now they know if you get sick, that is my problem. So, you know, we are starting to realize that, you know, and I know it's something you've been working on for so long, the sort of interconnectedness of us, it becomes really real in times like this. You know, we heard of a story of a patient in South Korea who was infected with COVID-19, and she thought she had a little fever, but she didn't get treated too much. She ended up going to church, and then people from her church ended up going to a funeral. She went to a few other things, and researchers out there think that just her infection alone might be responsible for about 5,000 other infections in the country. And yeah. So, you know, mm-hmm. if there's ever a lesson as to the influence we can have on each other and on so many other people, sometimes that influence is bad, but most of the time it's good, right? If we can ever recognize that sort of influence we might have on society, I think maybe now it's making it a lot more clear to everybody.
Yeah, it's amazing what this has done at so many levels. And yeah. Just a question of, you know, this gives an unprecedented blow to individualism.
Right.
That thought that, you know what, I close my door and I have nothing to do with anything that's going on out there. That just, and not only at a local level or a national level, international level. That has put an end to this way of thinking. Now it matters.
Right.
It matters what is the appetite of a person in Wuhan
right.
to me over here.
Right.
You know, international education, health, etc. So when I want to give an update. So today is March 25th, 2020. And the reported cases in Michigan on Michigan.gov is 2,294 with 43 deaths. The mm-hmm. highest number is in the city of Detroit. Any reflections on these numbers, Amir?
Look, I mean, I think what we're seeing, I think a week ago it was 30 or 40 infections in Michigan. You know, yesterday it was 1,800. Today it's almost 2,300. I mean, look, this is, like you said, a message that not only you say we're in this together, yes, but more precisely, it means that our successes are everyone's successes and our failures are everyone's failures, right? We are so connected. No one really does anything by themselves. No one really gets to where they are, whether it's a good place or a bad place, by themselves or independent of the system that we live in. Right. I mean, we live in a system, unfortunately, where poor people and people of color are going to be adversely affected by this thing, not because COVID-19 discriminates against, you know, people based on their skin color or their class, but healthcare does. How you get treated by a doctor, how you get treated by the government when you're of a non-white race or a lower economic class, those things we all know have a bearing on people's quality of life. And that's something that we've been trying to argue against for a long time, right? I mean, no one, you know, COVID-19, you know, didn't happen because of a sort of capitalist system gone, you know, run amok. No, but its effects are being made worse in part because of that. When we don't have a system that is prepared to stand up and fight for the weakest among us, you know, we still have a system in this country where profits come before your healthcare, where you can go bankrupt if you get sick or you can die because you're poor. It seems like, you know, we're waking up a little bit to realize that's not a great system. But the reason we're not as prepared for this is that, hey, if a hospital is a business, then they're not going to buy more beds than they think they need. They're not going to buy more ventilators than they think they need. They're not going to prepare for the worst. Think about another system that is run by the government, which is national defense. They never run out of tanks or weapons or aircraft carriers because they have major stockpiles prepared for the worst. Well, if we can do that for war, then we should be able to do it for health. You know, I don't think I'm not against, and I don't think, you know, I don't think you'll find any Arab American, because we come here and we tend to many times do well. No one is for government taking over all business or anything like that. But when it comes to healthcare, that's something that we need to wake up and see, look, we need to treat this the same way we treat national defense. We need to treat this in a way where profits have no bearing on this system at all, right? Profits could be important as to who makes the best hamburger, who makes the best hookah on Warren, who makes the best falafel. Okay, I'll pay more for that. But not when it comes to care, not when it comes to healthcare. And that's sort of the message we've been trying to say. So this interconnectedness that we're seeing now, hopefully will translate into some real change. I'm not super optimistic about that, but it's an opportunity for those of us who believe in that to push for that very strongly at this moment.
And it's amazing how right away they said that those who are going to be treated for COVID-19, they don't have to worry about the medical bill, that no one's going to be turned back. It's all of a sudden, they knew that there was something wrong. You know, it's like instinctively, we were doing the wrong thing. And in this situation, we couldn't, you know, we had to get real. And right away, they, you know, all of a sudden, this idea of free care for everyone became the right thing to do, as if we knew all along that it is the right thing to do.
Well, the truth is, right, what happened is that politically now it became sort of unfeasible for any politician to say, well, you know, no, profit has to drive this. The truth is, we, Sam, as you know, that when there wasn't COVID-19, there were already people dying because they weren't getting the care they need because they didn't have enough money or they didn't have the right access. That kind of stuff has been happening for years. But, you know, when it happens at a slower pace, unfortunately, our society doesn't take as much note of it. Now that it's happening in a way that could be at a very fast pace and catastrophic in a short period of time, hopefully people will see it. I think it's our job as activists or intellectuals or people who want to make this point to say, look, this is not something new, right? This is, we're seeing sort of it all happening at once because of this particular outbreak. But people have been dying because they're not getting the right care or not getting or not having the right access to care for a long time. And it's because they've been poor or minorities. And we have to keep pushing on that point to say, look, every day for some people is COVID-19. Every day when you don't have insurance, when you're underinsured, we're seeing now that having your insurance tied to your employer is not a great idea because people are being laid off by the millions and their insurance is going right along with that. So, I mean, healthcare is a human right. Making sure that your society is healthy is a recipe for further success and a recipe for having, you know, a mentally healthy society and a mentally smart society. I mean, geez, I tell this joke all the time that, you know, we are a country of 330 million people who has a game show called Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader that nobody wins. I mean, you know, nobody wins. And so we really have to work on making sure that we're staying healthy in all our ways. Other countries have already done this. I mean, the funny thing is we're not talking about something unique. We're talking about simply, you know, doing what other countries are doing that are having better results than us. So
thank you.
That's really what we got to use this moment for.
Yeah. So going back to you, Amer, so a lot of your shows are canceled. You're at home mostly. So how does, as a comedian who and an activist, so most of your every day out and about, traveling, doing shows, meeting people. So all of a sudden you're back home. At a personal level, is that an opportunity for some projects that you wanted to do? Is there a project that you're doing at home that you feel now it's an opportunity for?
Well, you know, for me, my job is communication, right? Communicating with people from a stage. And without that, I'm trying to find other ways to communicate with people. And I've been using the internet and social media for a while, but I'll be using it even more and been using it even more. I did there's another local Arab American musician here named Francis Bataya, who's a great local musician who I've known for a long time. And I just went to his house the other night on Friday night, and we just sat in front of a camera and tried to entertain people for a couple hours because we knew everyone was home, and, you know, thousands of people watched, and it was pretty cool. Usually on a Friday night, I'd be in some, you know, other city doing a comedy show. I did a live talk a couple nights ago about the census. I'm trying to stay connected and use other forms of communication with large groups of people. You know, I'm lucky. Mm-hmm. My job is I get to stand up in front of 200-300, sometimes 500 or 600 people 2-3 nights a week and just say what I think. And that's very like therapeutic. And there's no other art form that gives you that, you know, whether it's writing or playing music or whatever. And so that's something that is, I miss a lot. But mm-hmm. I'll tell you what, when we get out of this, I'll have a lot to say. And I think the first thing I'll do is have a big show in Dearborn and invite everybody and just, you know, just have a big party. But there is something missing. And yeah, I'm trying to work on other things, but I'm still trying to adjust to this new reality.
Yeah. Is there something that you consider inspirational from our situation today?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really inspired by the sort of volunteerism that's come out of, you know, just our community here in Dearborn. I think everyone is seeing the stories of, you know, people, especially young people, spending their time, and everyone has a lot of free time now, whether it's packing lunches at schools to give out to children who should be getting school lunches every day, whether it is going and distributing supplies to our local hospitals. There's such a high level of volunteerism in our community. And I truly, truly believe that it is connected to our culture and our upbringing. I mean, we are taught in our culture, brought down by generations, that, you know, we are in this together. That you look out for the weakest among you, that you fight for people that you don't know, that you really stand up for justice and morality when it's right. And so to me, I'm not surprised by the volunteerism coming out of our community, but it's really great to see it. So that's a very inspirational to me. And it's something that we have to highlight so everyone in the world sees it. Because, I mean, look, we do live in a world where we are, you know, frankly, as Arab Americans, maligned so much. I'm not surprised by the volunteerism coming out of our community, but I would love to show it and share it with anyone who would be, so that we can make sure that our messages are heard loud and clear.
Awesome. Do you feel that I feel it's definite that we are going to come out of this a little bit changed? Yeah. What are some of the things you feel we're going to change, the ways we're going to change after this? And what do you hope? How do you hope we will change?
You know, I think what we're going to see when we get out of this is, and I agree, I mean, I think this is going to change our society, and it's a global thing. So it's going to change our world permanently. just like many other sort of major global events have. And I think the way that this is going to change things, and we're already seeing it, especially now, and I think it'll stay with us, is this a heightened consideration of others. And I hope that stays with us forever. I think there will be some on the other spectrum of small minority who view it as a time to blame, as a time to really look down on others. But that's going to be the minority. They might be a little loud every now and then. But I think the majority of people will come out of this understanding again the interconnectedness and this heightened consideration of others that we have to have. I mean, you're just not going to succeed in this world, right? You might make a lot of money, you might, but you're not going to succeed with others. You're not going to succeed with what really matters, with others respecting you and taking you seriously, if you don't have this heightened consideration. And I think everyone is starting to understand that because it's literally hitting home for everybody. So I think that's how we're going to grow after this, but it remains incumbent upon, you know, activists like you and many other people to keep reminding people of that, because it is going to be a process, but hopefully we'll come out much better as a result of all this.
All right. Thank you. What's up with the toilet papers hoarding, Hamar? What's
I don't know. I mean, you know, I mean, mathematically, you know, I don't think this virus comes with any sort of like bowel diseases. So I think mathematically, theoretically, we should be using the same amount of toilet paper we used before. So the hoarding thing, you know, look, somebody must have thought that, you know, you're going to be stuck in your house forever and ever. Arabs don't have this problem. We have plumbing set up in most of our places that takes care of this.
Against the ordinances of the cities.
I don't care. I mean, you know, it can be against the city might not like it, but many parts of my body like it. Yeah. And, you know, it is, a lot of funny jokes out of our community came out of that. Look, I mean, people overreact, you know, not only you see toilet paper, you see hand sanitizer, you see everything. And the truth is, you know, America, it's funny. Because while the healthcare system suffers from a lack of basically supply, because demand is never high enough to have enough beds, and it takes a lot of time to build new beds and build new ventilators. Well, guess what? When the Dollar Tree runs out of toilet paper and hand sanitizer on Tuesday, the shelves are restocked by Wednesday. You know, they have stuff the next day. Capitalism seems to be responding very well to the high demand of people for toilet paper and hand sanitizer. For some reason, it doesn't respond very well to the high demand of people who need healthcare. So, you know, I think the first week people freaked out a little bit. Now you can basically find everything you need everywhere. But this is human nature, right? And a lot of this came from the unknown. You know, this is something, a virus that people have never seen before. And they just started freaking out and not knowing what to do. So it became toilet paper. So, you know, hopefully now, I mean, I guess people aren't going to be buying toilet paper for a long time. The toilet paper industry is going to have to wean down their production for a little while. Yeah. But I would encourage people to get that little, you know, get that little hose in your bathroom. Trust me, it feels a lot better.
Yeah. Or the bidet thing that is sold on
yeah.
Amazon. It's always, I think I tweeted first attempting to create a joke you know, dear Americans, if you walk into a bathroom and you find a bottle, please leave it there.
That's right.
It's a long story.
Well, you know, I went into a business on Warren Avenue about a couple months ago, actually, before this all started. And I won't say which business, but there's certain signs in businesses that in Dearborn that you only find in Dearborn. So one had a piece of paper on the bathroom door that said, please no water bottles in the bathroom. Now, unless you know what that's about, it doesn't make any sense to you. You know, white people walk in and they're like, wow, they don't let people drink water in the bathroom? That's crazy. But you know, it is it's something that there's also another sign at a place in Dearborn that says, there's a big sign on the counter that says, please don't leave your children on the counter unattended.
Yeah.
Okay. which means there was, you know, some Arab mom putting her kid on the counter and then making her order. And then, you know, the kid fell off. Because listen, you know as well as I do, right? You don't put up a sign unless you have to. You know, you only put up a sign because something happened. And so there were too many water bottles in that bathroom and there were too many kids falling off counters. So they had to put up these signs.
I've always thought, you know, you can do a photo book about signs in Dearborn. It's so funny. There was one sign of on a bar says beer pong, bikini girls, and halal ribs.
Oh yeah. Listen, the biggest strip club in Dearborn serves halal wings. And, you know, this is, they used to have it on their marquee that they served halal wings. And hey, you know what? I'm not mad at them. This is, you have to know, it's called customer service. You know your customers.
Yes.
That's right. And
no,
again,
actually, it's culture, you know, it's culture evolves in peculiar ways.
It's respect. It means the strip club respects us and they are giving us halal wings. But, you know, again, that had to happen because, you know, the situation came up where, you know, an Arab guy walks into the strip club and says, hey, let me have the gir with the big, another thing, is the chicken religiously certified halal? Because if it is not, I don't think I can really eat it. And also, let me get one Johnny Walker. You know, I mean, that's what happened.
It's probably a true story.
Oh, that had to be what happened. The strip club owner of Dearborn does not on his own write halal wings on the marquee. That is from customer demand.
Right. And, you know, again, it's we're not criticizing. It's just interesting culture.
Yeah.
I think the funniest sign I've seen is in one of the restaurants in the South End where it's a paper, handwritten, stuck on the wall, says the restaurant is only for food. I'm not going to do it with your accent, but the restaurant is only for food, no politics. And I thought that... and I thought that's very special, like only in Dearborn, hashtag.
Of course.
Amr, because we have a maximum of half an hour left and we want to get to two important subjects that you were very personally involved in. I want to get to the Bernie Sanders campaign.
Yeah.
Now, what happened there? I mean, I had the same shock of him losing Tuesday. What is it called?
Super Tuesday.
The same shock I had when Trump won in 2016.
Yeah.
So I wasn't expecting that. What happened?
Well, look, I mean, as we saw, it's a lesson in class solidarity, right? What we saw on the Saturday before Super Tuesday, when Joe Biden won South Carolina, let's call it moderate sort of establishment corporate wing of the Democratic Party, that class coalesced immediately. Pete Buttigieg dropped out. Amy Klobuchar dropped out. They all immediately endorsed Joe Biden. The day after Super Tuesday, Mike Bloomberg, the morning after, dropped out and endorsed Joe Biden. This sort of class solidarity among the elite was something that we saw. And look, there's a lot of people out there that are sort of fooled by these arguments. You know, they think, well, hey, because the establishment is getting behind somebody, it must mean that they're good. And Bernie went from, you know, being first among many to being ganged up on, you know, 5-6 on one. And then Elizabeth Warren left the race after Super Tuesday and decided that she didn't want to endorse the candidate that she was most ideologically aligned with. And that's another lesson in class solidarity. She's choosing which class she wants to be in for her own future. Unfortunately, I think that's what happened. And so we see Bernie still left alone and still doing, you know, pretty well under such circumstances. I mean, the Democratic Party is coalescing around Joe Biden this year way more than they coalesced around Hillary Clinton in 2016. Remember, in 2016, it was really just Hillary and Bernie from the beginning. This time around, you had, you know, started out with 20 candidates, and then you ended up with five or six serious candidates going into Super Tuesday, who all had lots of resources, lots of staff, lots of followers. And within 24 hours, basically, they all coalesced behind the corporate establishment candidate. And, you know, here's what we're telling people. This way of doing things, it might win you a primary, right? In these sort of, in this really sort of walled off two-party system that we have. But when it comes to a general election, this corporate elitist Democratic strategy, it really hasn't worked. You know, Al Gore was their favorite in 2000. He lost. John Kerry was their favorite in 2004. He lost. Clinton was their favorite in 2008. It took Obama coming along with an inspirational and motivational campaign. Turns out he was a corporate Democrat too, but his campaign was not a campaign of moderation. And he won. And then Hillary Clinton was the darling again in 2016, and she lost. So this notion of campaigning on moderation, it might make some people in the party feel good. It doesn't win a general election where turnout is much higher than it is in the primaries. A lot of these primaries are closed primaries where you had to be registered Democrats, and Bernie has never been a registered Democrat other than for the primary process. And he's still doing, you know, as well as he's doing. I think it's becoming clear now with the coronavirus pandemic and with Biden's performance on social media and some recordings lately that I think some people might start to rethink, especially now since the primaries have basically come to a pause. And probably won't be picked up again till late May, maybe, or early June. We might have like another Super Tuesday in late May or early June where, you know, 25 states vote in the span of 1 to 2 weeks. And that is, we might live in a totally different world by then politically than we live now. But Bernie Sanders is not dropping out. We saw the effects of that corporate class coalescing together. But I think many more people are going to start to make their voices heard. And I think there's a chance for things to turn around. Look, the good thing about Bernie Sanders is he doesn't conduct his campaign thinking about what's going to happen to me. What is my political future? Is it best for my political future to drop out? He doesn't think like that. He thinks in terms of his ideology and the people that he is representing. And the truth is, at the end of the day, he still has more donors than any other campaign. He still has more grassroots than any other campaign. And we have to work hard to make sure our messages are heard and get through to everybody. And hopefully that ends up with Bernie being the nominee. But the truth is,
he still has chance.
Of course. Of course. Look, the way the math works and the system works from the screen that you have, that 1215 number for Biden has to get to 1991. And there's still, I think, 25 or 26 contests left. Mm-hmm. So is Biden have a lead, a big lead? Sure. It's not insurmountable, especially given the very volatile political environment that we live in, the volatile economic environment that we live in. Basically, every policy that Bernie has been advocating is now becoming the talking point of every politician in this crisis. How much better would it be if we just lived in that world all the time? You know, we'd be more prepared for things like this. And so, you know, this is, I think this is going to be a very clear message. Now, again, the corporate elite class of the Democratic Party has decided they want it to be over. Bernie has said, you know, there's supposed to be a Democratic debate in April. Bernie has said he would like to go to that debate and debate Joe Biden again. Biden today was quoted as saying he doesn't want to debate anymore. He doesn't think there should be any more debates. He thinks this thing is over, even though, again, he's far away from the threshold needed to win. And so I think we're going to see a lot of political back and forth as this thing goes on. But yes, there is still a chance, of course.
So a question for you. So from the donations, we know that he has, he surpasses anyone in the number of donations.
Yeah.
In the number of contributors, you know, to his campaign. Yeah. As far as those who are under the age of 29, he has a landslide when over that age bracket. Yeah. In terms of his rallies and the show up in his rallies, the energy in his rallies, they surpass any other candidate by far. What is happening at the? Is it that the youth are not showing up to vote, or what's going? Are the older generation showing up more? What's going? What's happening? I mean, I'm sure you have data that enlightens you in that respect.
Sure. So Bernie's people are showing up more, and the youth are showing up a little bit more. In Iowa, for instance, youth voter turnout in the caucus was up from 2016. Youth voter turnout was up in Michigan, but turnout in other groups was up too, and in many places up more, especially among older voters who are frankly scared of Trump. And they do, I think, wrongly view the moderate message as a way to beat Trump. I don't think that's right. I don't think that's going to happen. But a lot of people have come out more. But the truth is, you can bring out people in the primary, but it's more about bringing out people in the general election. Bernie opens up the political process to millions and millions of people. The reason that one of the reasons, by the way, that Democrat turnout in the primaries is up is because Bernie brings in so many people into the process that haven't been in the process before. Take Dearborn. You know, Dearborn is a good snapshot of Arab America as a whole. In 2016, 12,000 people came out to vote in the Democratic primary. In 2020, 18,000 people came out to vote in the Democratic primary. That's a 50% increase. It's very high. Mm-hmm. And our community of Arab Americans came out to vote in higher numbers and overwhelmingly for Bernie Sanders. Somewhere from 85 to 90% of Arab Americans in Dearborn voted for Bernie Sanders. So it showed that our numbers are greater and we're unified, which are two very strong indicators of political power and respect. And so to me, I see that that's what the Bernie Sanders campaign is doing in a lot of communities, immigrant communities, Arab communities, Muslim communities, Latino communities, a lot of work to do still in Black communities, and a lot of work to do with older Black voters. But the truth is, at the end of the day, a lot of these traditional Democratic voters, they're going to vote for the Democratic nominee, whoever it is. Whereas on the other hand, Bernie, who functions in this sort of hybrid way in the Democratic Party, but also lots of independents and new voters who don't really feel an allegiance to a particular political party, they're not going to vote for a Democrat just because they're a Democrat. They're going to vote for someone who speaks to their issues. And so I think that's a big liability for the Democratic Party in November if they push in this way to protect their corporate interests and nominate Joe Biden.
Hamer, you've had the close encounters with Bernie Sanders during this year and last year, right?
Yeah.
Do you have a story that you know, something happened and you felt like that you know, you were really happy that you're voting for this guy, or that you're you know, standing with this guy? Is there a story, a personal story you'd like to share with us?
In fact, it's a story, and it's sort of an ongoing episode, right? As you know, as a Palestinian activist, one of the things that I deal with all the time is, you know, being accused of hating Jews and being anti-Semitic, you know, all the time. And so when I was brought onto the campaign back in October, until today, stories come out, you know, not in mainstream media, but in a lot of like alternative and right-wing media about me all the time, being anti-Semitic and hating Jews, and how that's connected to the Bernie, you know, how dare the Bernie Sanders campaign keep this person on and all that kind of stuff. The campaign has never wavered from me. In fact, they called me a couple months ago when a lot of these stories were hitting the news very hard. And they said, you know, someone who's an advisor right under Bernie said to me, "Hey, I just spoke with the senator about the situation, and we want to let you know that we are standing behind you. We are not going to cut you loose. We're not going to give in to any of this pressure." We are staying with you, and you know, you don't have anything to worry about. And that to me was a very important sort of, I kind of knew that, but it was important to hear it from a high level of the campaign. Because again, this campaign was about including people. And then when I, you know, before I introduced Bernie at the rally that we had in Dearborn a couple weeks ago, I went back to say hello to him and I said, "Hey Bernie, I'm Amr Zar." And he goes, I know who you are. And he said, "We Semites, we got to stick together." So I said, yes, we do, Senator. And so, you know, they can call me anti-Semitic all they want. I mean, I don't know. I must be the worst anti-Semite in the world. You know, I'm supporting the only Jewish guy running for president. You know, I don't know what I must have missed the first day of anti-Semite school where, you know, where I imagine the first lesson would be something like, look, if a Jewish guy is running for president, don't support him. But, you know, this sort of right-wing attacks, usually Arab Americans, Palestinian Americans, Muslim Americans, were usually toxic to any politician, and especially a presidential campaign. But when this campaign has said to me very clearly, hey, despite the attacks we hear, despite the strength of the pro-Israel lobby, we stand with you. We stand with your message and stand with your community. That's a very, very strong, inspiring message from a campaign who might gain more, possibly, or might think that they gain more by cutting me loose. And it's happened to many people in our community before. This campaign did the exact opposite. So that's a storyline, sorry, that has stuck with me throughout this campaign.
Yeah, and that dichotomy is amazingly represented, especially in your article that you wrote for Haaretz.
Yeah.
We Arab Americans and Muslims are voting for Bernie because he's Jewish.
Yeah.
What were the vibrations, the echo of this article? Tell us a little bit more, because was this your first time writing for Haaretz?
Yes, the first time I wrote for Haaretz, and you know, they reached out to me. The opinion editor reached out to me, asked me to write something in this vein when I had said a couple things like that on social media. And you know, I'm also fairly well known, for good reasons or bad reasons, in Israeli media and Israeli society. I hold a, you know, Israeli passport as a Palestinian who is from Nazareth, Iddachil, Aradit Menu Arbin, or Israel proper. And so when they reached out to me, I said, you know, I'll write it, but you can't edit it. And they said, no problem. I said, if you're going to edit it, then I just don't want you to publish it at all. They said, no problem. And so, you know, my point here is, again, to point out the ridiculousness, and it's been happening since 2016. And I said it in my speech when I introduced Bernie the other day, which is, you know, when you ask an Arab American or a Palestinian American, please explain to me how you're supporting the Jewish guy, that's an inherently very racist question, right? It assumes that we are raised or genetically predisposed with some sort of hatred for Jews. And in fact, there's probably no group of people, and you know this better than anyone, Wissam, who differentiates between what the Israeli state does and Jewish people. No one differentiates between those two things or compartmentalizes those two things more than Arabs and Palestinians who have been dealing with this question for, you know, decades. We know that they're not the same thing. We know. In fact, it's the Israeli society and Israeli government that tells us that they're the same thing, not us. And we try to say, no, we make this differentiation. And so the fact that Bernie Sanders is Jewish is not something we take into account, other than maybe, as I said in my article, other than in a positive way. When he talks about his coming from an immigrant father, that's something that we all connect with, right? That's something that a lot of older Jewish people have as their story. When he talks about coming from a tradition of suffering through the Holocaust, that's something that people connect with. Not that the Holocaust is the same thing as anything else, but this notion of coming from war and war-torn places and suffering and being refugees, something that we all connect with through our family stories. And yes, he talks about Palestine in a fundamentally different way and can talk about Palestine in a fundamentally different way because he's Jewish. And so, yes, when I say we supported him because he's Jewish, that's what I mean. His identity lends itself, and he's talked about his identity lending itself to this notion of seeing that we're all in this together and this notion of collectivism, but also his immigrant upbringing, also coming from a tradition of suffering, also being to talk about Palestine in a more principled way. All those things attract us to his campaign along with the messages of his campaign. That was something that we've dealt with this question forever. And I use that article as a way to sort of like, you know, flesh out, you know, this sort of thing that we go through all the time to the readers. And it was one of their most shared articles, I think, of the year.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. And thank you on behalf of the community for writing such an article at an internationally recognized newspaper and reaching the actual Israeli audience too. About our symbolic support as Arab Americans. Amar, you've been
talking. And I want to let me make one point about this too, because there's a lot of people in our community sometimes who think, and I just because they don't, and it's not out of innocence, but they think that, you know, if I write something for an Israeli newspaper, and Haaretz is an Israeli newspaper, and yes, they are a liberal Zionist newspaper. If I write something for a newspaper that I'm normalizing Israel, or the word we use in Arabic is tatbiya, that's not true, okay? Normalization or tatbiya is when you deal with a Zionist institution or a Zionist organization or an individual without bringing up Palestine, without talking about the issues of justice and morality in Palestine, which I did in my article from the beginning, is when you deal with these institutions pretending that Palestine is not an issue because you both, you know, like hummus or you both like whatever you like and you're just looking at your common ground and you're not dealing with the core issue, that's normalization, right? It's not normalization. So in other words, communication or engagement is not alone normalization. It's only normalization when you engage in that sort of thing, that sort of relationship with a Zionist group without centering the issue of Palestine. But I always make sure not to do that. And in fact, much can be gained by talking with these groups and talking clearly and morally about Palestine. Martin Luther King did it with white people. Nelson Mandela did it with white people. You know, talking with people who might support your oppressor is not normalization unless you don't talk about your struggle. Definitely. Just to be clear on that point.
Yeah, that's a good thing that to clarify it. But I mean, journalism is journalism, no matter where it is. And you specifically, you yourself, you don't have, even if you haven't made that point in within that article, you, with everything that you do and your book and your articles, you stand up for that and you symbolize that. Also, Haaretz itself is a very liberal a newspaper that, in many cases, it stands actually stands unbiased in so many cases, really.
Yeah.
To say the truth. We are running out of time, but we have to go to the census. I mean, you've said enough about the census on your website. You've been actually in the forefront of that. I'm going to share here your Facebook page of the documentary that you've created a few years ago, right?
Yeah.
We Are Not White. And then you made recently a statement and a video, very effective videos, Amir, that you're making. And we've talked about this. I have a podcast series called Arab American Identity, and I finish from my current guest, I'd like to start with you about that, because I know you have a lot to say about that, and you've made these points in the last couple of times. Just as a reminder for people who are gonna watch this, haven't watched your videos, is that you wanna give the reminder yourself?
Well, sure. So by now, many of you should have received in your mail the census form. You can fill it out, the form that you received, or you can fill it out online at census.gov. But every 10 years, we do the census in America. It's part of the Constitution. And they ask from the beginning of time, really, because America has always been obsessed with race and racial identification, they've asked people, what's your race on the census? Now, Arab Americans have never had a box. We've technically been considered white for over 100 years. I won't get too much into that, but that happened because naturalization laws from 1790 until 1952 required that you were white, had to be white in order to be naturalized as a citizen. Many communities petitioned for whiteness. Most of them lost. We happened to win, mainly because those early Arab immigrants that were coming were from the Bilad al-Sham or Greater Syria, so they didn't look too dark, and they were all Christian. So they were granted whiteness at that time. But anyway, it's been a misidentification for years. So now the 2020 census is different for the first time, in which, whereas in the past, even if you wrote other and you wrote in Arab or you wrote in, you know, Palestinian or Lebanese or whatever, they would simply throw you into whiteness and you wouldn't, that identification that you made wouldn't come along with you in the statistics. This year, for the first time, they're actually specifying whiteness. So you get to say you're white and then what kind of white person you are, or you can say other and what kind of other person you are. And no matter what you write, as long as it's something that falls in the under the umbrella of Middle East or North Africa, they will reclassify you as white, even if you write other. But for the first time, they're going to take whatever identification you wrote and count that. So in other words, if at the end of the day, I have five people who check white and write Palestinian and five people who check other and write Palestinian, the census will tell me that there were 10 white people who checked Palestinian. Before, they would just tell me that there was 10 white people and I wouldn't know who they were. But now they're going to tell me there's 10 white people who checked Palestinian. So I'm still going to get that number. And so what I'm asking people to do is, whether you want to check white or other, I'm encouraging you to check other because we're not white. I'd like it to show in the census that the majority of our people, even though you're calling us white, checked other. I'd like the census to see that the majority of our people checked other. I'd like the census to see that the majority of our people checked other, so that'll give us a better case to get a box next time around. So yes, that would be very important to me.
You don't care right now about what exactly for people. Do you have, like, can you give a recommendation of what would like to see Arab Americans put?
So my recommendation would be to first go down to some other race and check some other race. And then look, I don't want to tell people what their identity is. Put whatever you want. The truth is, race is such a socially constructed, fluid idea that anything is a race, right? So if you want to write, I know you advocate for people to write Arab. I think that's great. I'm going to write Palestinian. If some people want to write Lebanese, they want to write Egyptian. If they want to write Coptic or Chaldean, the only term I really don't like is Middle Eastern, because it's, you know, colonial and it's not what we call ourselves. Right. But, you know, if somebody wants to write, you know, Ramallawi, if they want to write Birawi, if they want to write from Tibnin, whatever, you identify how you identify. In a perfect world, there would be a box that said, Arab, please specify. That would be the perfect world. And that's where I hope that we can get to in the 2030 census, where there's a box, just like there's a Hispanic box, just like there's an Asian box, there should be an Arab box. And then from there, you can specify what kind of Arab you are. Because look, yes, I believe in Pan-Arabism. Arabs are, we're all connected because of our culture and our ethnicity and our linguistics and all that kind of stuff. The truth is, we have that greater connection, but we also have sort of particular cultures inside of that and particular politics inside of that. So I'm very connected to a Moroccan in many ways, but there's many ways that their desires and politics and needs in a community might be different than mine. So that while it's important to know as a greater number how many Arabs there are in the country according to the census, it's also important to know according to the census how many Moroccans there are and how many Lebanese there are and how many Palestinians there are. So I would encourage people to write in their country, because I know when you write in your country, you're identifying as an Arab. But when you write in your country, I get the double sort of data. So if you write Lebanese, it lets me know at the end of the day when I'm counting, when I'm getting all the data from the census that I'll get in 2021. It'll let me know that, yes, you're an Arab. I'm going to put you under the Arab umbrella when I'm counting all these people. But it also lets me know, okay, you're a Lebanese person in Michigan. Now I know how many Arabs there are in Michigan, and I know among the Arabs how many Lebanese there are in Michigan.
Well, from a data perspective, I'm with you 100%. That's an excellent idea.
But again, the issue that you're having, but the reason a lot of people might write Arab is because we're being misidentified on the census. We should have our own box that says Arab. Like if there was a box that said, are you Arab, and tell me what kind of Arab you are, then you don't need to write Arab in the box because you're already under an Arab umbrella and you can write Lebanese or Moroccan or Sudani or Kuwait or whatever. And then the numbers would be much clearer. But we're running into the problem we run into because we don't have the right classification the way it should be, the way everyone else does.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's a good point, Amr, that it is from a data perspective, it's good to also know data of Arab Americans from which countries they're at. I personally, my problem is that I don't recognize these countries. Like, I refuse to be less Iraqi than an Iraqi, you know?
Right. And I understand all that. You know, at the same time, we live in a real world where colonial, and I get it, I'm anti-colonialism and all that kind of stuff, but you know, colonialism is why I call myself a Palestinian and why my land under those specific borders was taken from me. Mm-hmm. And those specific borders mean something to me because of a suffering that I existed under the hands of colonialism that wrote those borders. So yes, we can reject them and sort of recognize their significance in our lives at the same time.
Right. And, you know, for more on that, you can refer back to the book Palestinian Identity by Rashid Al-Khalidi, right?
Yes. Yes, of course. He's the master on this. Yeah, right. We all learn from him.
So, and the talk about identity and race is really needs a separate thing. But thank you for that message. It's very important for us to propagate. I worked in the Department of Treasury in the census, the last census, 2010, the one before it, the year 2000.
2000. Yeah.
I worked in that census, and I worked, I couldn't give recommendation. I had to, you know. But I.
Oh, you mean like you went door to door?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I just had to tell them what do you think you are? What's your race? And I, inside of me, I celebrated every time they said Arab, you know, but yeah. I couldn't.
Yeah, but
them.
See, unfortunately, you know, back then, if they checked, there was no white police specified.
Right. I didn't know that. It didn't matter.
And that's right. So if they write some other race and they write Arab, it's nice that they did that, but it didn't get counted.
And they didn't keep data of that? It's ridiculous.
I mean, maybe they did internally, but it's not in any of their published data. Whereas now, for the first time, it will be. And, you know, the irony of this is that Trump did this white please specify thing because he wants white people to be prouder of their origin. It's really sort of like a white nationalistic thing. Never have we cared about whether somebody is like Polish or Hungarian or Italian or Irish too much in the census. Right. Now you're gonna get numbers back for the first time ever of how many people identify as Italian, how many people identify as Irish, how many people identify as Hungarian or German or whatever. You know, they didn't give us our own box, because also if you give us our own box, it lessens the overall number of white people, which a lot of white people are freaking out about, because they know the brownification of America is happening, and white people are becoming less and less percentage wise. So it's really interesting, but we have to at least take advantage of the tools that we have now to use. So my recommendation would be, check some other race and write in your country. That would be my recommendation to everybody.
Okay. Thank you, Amer. And we are getting to the end of the episode, and I have a few questions for you that are a tradition in this time of quarantine, which are, can you tell us what is a book that you've read lastly, and what is a book that you recommend for people to read?
So there's two books. One of them is called Zealot by Reza Eslan. Reza Eslan is an American religious scholar. Zealot is this great book about, it's basically a sort of like a secular biography of Jesus. Really, really, really great book, written in a great storytelling type way. So I would recommend people read that. The other book is, I want to make sure I get the right title of it, but it's by somebody called Leslie Hazelton, and she wrote a book called After the Prophet. It tells in a great storytelling way, it's called After the Prophet, a great storytelling way of the history of the sort of initial and the origins of the break between that led us to the Sunni Shia break that we have historically. I love books that tell history in a storytelling way. I'm not a big reader of novels. I'm a big reader of history, and those two books are books that I've read before, and I'm rereading them now. And then any book by Edward Said, everyone should read. Everyone should read Orientalism just to understand the way the world operates. And you only need to read the first chapter, which is like 50 or 60 pages. You don't need to read the whole rest of the book, although you should. But everyone should read Orientalism. Take this time to read it again. But I dive into books about political thought and history.
It's a little bit of a heavy read, but it's definitely one of the most important books for Arab Americans.
Yes. Orientalism is a heavy read. You know, Edward Said always wrote in a little flowery language, but read the first chapter and you'll be fine.
Song. I know that's a weird question these days.
Well, I love Arabic music.
But, you know, you can, because you can expose us to something that maybe we don't know or...
Well, I know I'm going to go back and re-listen to an Im Kulthum song called "Hasibek Lizzaman," definitely about Corona. This thing has been killing me. But you know, I try to listen to a little Arabic music every day. I always say, you know, if you Fairuz should make you smile, Abdul Halim should make you cry, and Im Kulthum should make you angry. And if those three emotions are happening to you, then you're listening to them right. I mean, you're not gonna cry at a Fairuz song. They're just not that emotional. They're a little more happy. They're never angry. You don't smile at an Abdul Halim song. Every one of his songs is so sad. Oh, and just so sad. I mean, you know, I don't know. You can't leave Abdul Halim song in a good mood. It's just so, so sad. And then Im Kulthum, she makes you smile, but in kind of like an evil smile kind of way. And she doesn't make you sad other than the kind of sadness you have right before you get very angry. So Im Kulthum is more about, you know, angry love. Abdul Halim is sad love. Fairuz is happy love.
Interesting.
So
I mean, Abdul Halim himself, he hated one of his songs, one of the most famous songs, "Qari'at al-Finjan," written by Nizar Qabbani.
Yeah.
He himself like felt that it's too sad even for him, you know.
Well, and it's funny. It's funny because it was one of the last songs he sang in his life.
It is,
and it might
one
be
of the greatest.
And it might be the song that best describes his life. So maybe he was sort of projecting his anger against that song because it was so descriptive of who he was. But one I mean, there the is greatest. Just no. There is just no happy Abdul Halim song. I mean, just not even one. I mean, you know, even the happy ones are just not that happy. But, I think, you know, maybe the ISIS guys aren't that bad. They just have been listening to too much Abdul Halim music. and then they go out and they overreact, you know.
I wish that was their problem.
Yeah, right.
Is there a podcast that you listen to?
You know, I like listening to, I'm so typical. I love crime pod. Anything that's like a true crime podcast, I like listening to. I also just religiously listen to like Car Talk and, you know, some of these cheesy NPR shows. But anything that's like a true crime podcast, I listen to. There was a podcast about the death of Marilyn Monroe. I listened to that. It was like a 10-hour podcast. I listened to that. I've listened to the Serial podcast. Anything that's about true crime. And especially injustice in the crime system, I love listening to those kinds of podcasts.
And how about a film? What's the last film you watched and a film that you recommend?
So I've used this time actually to watch a couple films. I watched Moonlight again, which is a really, really wonderful film about Black life in America. I don't know if you've seen that film, but it won the Academy Award for Best Picture a few years ago. Moonlight, set in Florida. Great, great, great film. I watched that film again. And I've also taken the time to watch a couple rewatch a couple Palestinian movies like Divine Intervention and Omar. I would encourage people to just do that. But whatever you do, don't go watch the movie called The Insult. It was such a stupid movie. Did you ever watch that movie?
The Insult sounds familiar, but
the one by a Lebanese director a couple years ago.
Named Oh yeah. It wasn't really. It was.
I hated that movie.
Yeah, I didn't. It was good. It was good production and direction, but the storyline.
It was
weird. It's not unrepresentative.
Yeah.
And we have a habit, Amr, in each episode that you add a question, you ask a question that we added to the list of questions that we ask. I'm going to ask you the question of Hadi Al-Dibbe. His question was, what was the last epiphany or aha moment that you had?
So I cook a lot, okay? I like to cook. Okay. I'm a good cook. For all the ladies out there, I'm a great cook. Okay. The epiphany I had, and it was not very recently, but in the last 3 years, is that, and Wissam, I hope that your Lebanese ears can handle this, that hummus with garlic is not hummus. No garlic in hummus. Hummus is ruined by garlic.
Yes,
it does not belong.
Wait, I want my wife to hear that.
No. Hummus is very clear. It is it is hummus, tahini, lemon juice, and salt.
Hallelujah.
And that's it. You can add a little bit of the stock from the hummus when you cook it. If you need to make it a little thinner, that's fine. But garlic not belong. It is an abomination. It does not belong in hummus. It belongs in a lot of Arabic food. Falafel, shawarma, but not hummus.
How did it creep into our hummus?
I don't know.
It creeps to everything in our life. So
I don't like to blame everything on Lebanese people, but this one I might.
Who's your best? I mean, you know, we're not advertising anyone, but who's yeah. who's your best hummus in Dearborn?
The best hummus in Dearborn is actually at Biblos Banquet Hall. They make the best hummus, and trust me, I'm a connoisseur. I've tasted all the food in Dearborn, yeah. and they make the best hummus. The one thing that has still not been made right in Dearborn is falafel. Yeah, there is no good falafel. They just don't know. I don't know what it is, but let me be clear again, okay? There is no fool in falafel. Falafel is chickpeas only. Also, when you open a falafel, listen to me, all you restaurant people in here. When you open a falafel, it's not supposed to be yellow. It's supposed to be green because there's supposed to be a lot of parsley in there. That's what makes falafel falafel, that parsley herbaceous thing. Please learn how to make falafel.
Isn't that crazy? We're the capital of Arab America and America, and we don't have a good falafel. I mean, I think the best, as far as I'm concerned, is Habib's falafel. But
yeah, I've never had his falafel.
I mean, you know, San Francisco, New York, you'll get good falafel in some places there.
That's correct, because the people making falafel there are people that we call Palestinians. And the people making falafel here, I just don't know. It's supposed to be green. That's all you need to know. It's supposed to be green. That's all.
Okay. We'll leave it at that.
Okay.
Before it turns into Om Kulthum song.
That's right.
And the question asked by Dr. Adnan Jaber was, how are we not going to forget about what we've learned in this crisis? Like, when we come out, we know that there are things, like, for example, the appreciation of family, appreciation of seeing each other, appreciation of having a shawarma sandwich and Hamido. We're going to come out of it, and this appreciation for the simple things in life, we're going to go wherever we appreciate right now, or lessons we've learned, how do we not lose them after this crisis is long forgotten?
You know, I actually am not too worried about that, right? Because I think when things get taken away from you so abruptly, you know, it's only when things get taken away from you slowly that you don't notice how important they are. When they get taken away from you abruptly, hopefully you notice a lot more. You know, think about after 9/11. After 9/11, our whole world changed in terms of like security. So, you know, I remember in my 20s, my early 20s, when we flew before 9/11, you just showed up at the airport with a ticket. You didn't need your ID. You didn't need, as long as you had a ticket with a name on it, you went to the airport, you went through this small kind of crappy metal detector. And 9/11 changed all those things. Now, a lot of those things will say change for the worse, more profiling. Yes, all those things happen too. But my point is, it changed the culture fundamentally. I think that this thing is going to do that too. And hopefully much more of it will come out positive, because there is no real enemy right here, right? And the enemy here is Mother Nature or biology or whatever. It's not a group of people. And so hopefully I think we're going to come out of this with much more connectedness and much more appreciation of these small things. But again, it remains incumbent upon activists like you and me and others to keep reminding people about the importance of these things when this is all over.
Thank you, Amir. By the way, Lu'ay Sha'ar, he says, House of Falafel in Farmington. And you are
Listen,
welcome.
I mean, I'll go there and visit, but, you know, we live in Dearborn. I mean, I shouldn't have to drive to Farmington to get a falafel, although, you know, I will now, I'll go, but I shouldn't have to go that. I mean, it's probably cheaper for me to just open a falafel shop in Dearborn. So I think I'm going to open it. Yeah, I will.
And I would like to be your first customer.
Yes, sir.
And do hummus without garlic at once.
Of course. Also. No, I'm going to name it after my dad. I'm probably going to call it Abu Layla after my dad. It'll just be like, you know, like the places back home where you walk in, they just give you a bowl of hummus and you sit down and you eat it. A couple of heptan falafel and that's it. That's your meal. You know, we don't need to go into all this fanciness, you know. You have 2-3 things on the menu and that's it.
Right. One thing, by the way, so there's something that that also ticks me off about Lebanese. I'm Lebanese myself, you know, but they don't like the Nablusi knafa, the knafa yeah. Nablusi, and they like their own knafa thing. And yeah. I try to explain that all the Arab from Morocco to Iraq, they like the knafa Nablusi. That's the knafa. When people talk about knafa, that's the knafa they're talking about.
That's right.
Except the Lebanese, have their own thing. So when I talk about knafa, they always assume it's the, you know, it's the Lebanese knafa, and I say no, it is it's the other knafa. Anyway.
Yeah. What do we call it? Libano-centric. A view of the world. I'll tell you a funny story. A long time ago, I was at a friend's house, a Lebanese friend's house in Dearborn, and she had a couple of her cousins over from Lebanon. And before dinner, we were talking. I was telling jokes, all that kind of stuff. And then I heard one of them talking on the phone to her mom. And she was talking on the phone to her mom, and she said, "Ah, احنا مبسوطين نحنا مبسوطين وفي واحد هون اسمه عامر." بيضحك كتير وفلسطيني بس مرتب. So I mean, you know, there's already this, like, you know,
it's always best. It's always but if he's not Lebanese,
that's
always
right.
A but.
Always a فلسطيني بس مرتب.
It has to be a disclaimer after it.
That's right.
You know what I don't get, but I don't have time to talk about this, is when you're picking the keyboards on Microsoft.
Yeah.
Why is there like an Algerian keyboard? And what's the difference between an Algerian keyboard and an Egyptian keyboard?
I don't know. Anyway,
that's a different topic. Amr Zahar, what is your question that we're going to ask every guest after you and you're going to answer yourself too?
What Arabic food reminds you of your childhood?
Oh, how about that? Nice. Yeah. Nice.
I know my answer.
What is it?
Bamiye. That's beautiful. You have to get over, like, you have to. Bamiye is that beautiful slimy, the sliminess of bamiye. It has to be slimy or else it's not good. You know that, you know what I mean? Slimy, right? Has like that long dry, and then it's that's so beautiful. Yeah. Mm. Bamiye is what it is for me. I could smell it from a mile away.
Yeah. For me, it's basilla.
Yes.
I have a story. I say I didn't like basilla and rice, but I went to Kashaf. I went to Scouts.
Yeah.
When I was once at summer in Lebanon, and I went for a summer camp with the scouts. So that was my first scouting experience. And they were very harsh. It was very, very harsh scouting environment. on the first day, I started wanting to leave. And we went to lunch for the first day. They put ruz and basilla for everyone, rice and peas, right?
Yeah,
rice and green peas for everyone. And I told my scout leader that, oh, I don't eat green peas and rice. Do you have something else? And he said, oh, you don't eat green peas and rice. Okay.
Right.
And he put me like three plates. And he said, you're not leaving until all of it is eaten. So I started eating and crying.
That's
and then
right.
I kept crying until they took me out. And they took me back home. But I started liking
rice
and peas since then. And it's one of my favorite food.
It's delicious.
Amr Zahar, thank you very much for your time and for being with us tonight. We are in this together. We hope to come out of it and we can sit face to face. And for our listeners and followers, thank you very much. This episode will be posted on YouTube, dearbornblog.com. And also it will be podcasted on Dearborn Blog Podcast. Thank you, Amr, again.
Okay, إلى اللقاء.
Bye-bye.